Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, September 29th. In the waning days of Hawaiian History Month, we talk about the political pendulum swinging to the right with federal funding cuts that affect diversity, equity, and inclusion, and also Native Hawaiians, and the targeting of Kamehameha schools over its admission policy. We learn about a forum to focus on the past to help navigate the future. We hear from the new editor of Hawaii Business Magazine as it embraces the age of new media and a younger demographic. Plus, we talk to a conservation group that is sounding the alarm about a mass killing of native birds. And we take you on a walking tour that brings the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom back to life. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. To understand how to navigate the current choppy political waters, you need to understand the past. In a nod to Hawaiian History Month, a forum is to take place tomorrow on the last day of September. Esther Kia'aina will take part in the event to highlight the changing political climate and the concern that programs to help Native Hawaiians are being targeted. The Honolulu councilwoman previously worked in Washington, D.C. for the Interior Department and for Senator Dan Akaka. Kia'aina has a deep understanding of the inner workings of our nation's capital. The forum will look at the political history of Hawaiians and its relationship to the U.S. It's being sponsored by the mayor's office and the Honolulu City Council and will take place at the Mission Memorial Auditorium. Here's Kia'aina.
With all of the challenges that we're hearing about, I want the general public, the people of Hawaii, and our Native Hawaiian community to know that despite that, there are so many good things that have been going on within our community at all levels of government, and that at the core, we have a solid relationship, a unique and special relationship with the U.S. government, who've acknowledged that not only is indeed there is a trust relationship under the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, but through the 1993 Apology Resolution, also acknowledge its complicity in the overthrow and acknowledge the special relationship that they have overall with our community beyond the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. And that can't be forgotten because that was 30 years ago, right? 1993, right? Over 30 years ago. And a lot of the challenges that we're facing on the federal funding part is affecting people across the board in the country. And a lot of those decisions are being made for fiscal reasons. At the appropriate time, when they do challenge Native Hawaiian programs, then we will galvanize. But for now, I think it's important for us to understand what has happened in the last 30 to 40 years at all levels of government so that we could be proud of where we have come and where we are going.
I remember covering those hearings, and I remember being at, I think, the East-West Center, and Governor Waihe'e was talking, and it was just so interesting. When you looked around the room, the people that were standing up from Haunani Trask, it just was, I remember just thinking, wow, this is quite the moment in Hawaiian history, and I was just so privileged to be able to witness it.
And we forget, right? And I want to make sure that people know that all of the groundwork that has been laid by many of our community still stands, and that we need not be afraid. And that we should continue what we're doing, again, not just at the governmental level, but within our own respective communities.
I think that day, the governor paid tribute to everybody that had the courage to speak up about righting the wrongs of that part of Hawaii history. And it was very powerful.
Absolutely. And we've only gone up since that time and made significant strides. So again, I thought that given the fact that this is Hawaiian History Month, that why not have a panel discussion so that people will hear what is going on. We will be open to questions at the end for some of the challenges that they were facing. And based on our levels of expertise, we are more than welcome to answer that. Because at the end of the day, whoever is in the White House or whoever leads the Congress, we have faced that throughout our history. And there is no reason for us to be afraid or to go backwards. We can only go forward.
And then besides the federal perspective, the state perspective, I understand, will include Holly Watson, the director of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. And then the international perspective will also include, among others, Lili Kala, Kamehameha.
Yes, that's correct. And Brandon Maka'ava'ava, of course, who is the vice president of the Nation of Hawaii based in Waimanalo. And to be honest with you, I've been in this business for a long time. For all of us to be at different levels of government, this would not have happened 30 years ago because people would like to pit our Hawaiian community against each other, and we are saying no more. We are not competing with each other. We may have various different views on the issue, for example, of self-determination, but with regard to the truth of justice, right, the pursuit of justice, and redressing past wrongs and helping to improve the quality of life for our communities, we are on the same track. And we want everybody in Hawaii to know that, because in helping our own community, many of us, including the leadership here at the Honolulu City Council, we have 3 Native Hawaiians, all graduates of the Kamehameha schools. We are not just helping our Hawaiian community, we're helping all of the people of Oahu. And many of us dedicate our lives to helping address Native Hawaiian issues, but we do it against the backdrop of whatever kuleana we have or whatever hat we're wearing, and we do it side by side. And so the fact that we are having a diverse views represented here shows a level of maturity that didn't exist 30 years ago when people wanted us to be pitted against each other as if we were competing, when in fact we are not competing. And Lili Kala, Dr. Lili Kala Kamehameha, of course, thousands of students she has taught and she's taken to the United Nations. There's various processes at the United Nations, both with regard to indigenous peoples, but as well as the decolonization process with which a lot of territories are still ongoing, right, worldwide. That includes Guam. We have the Virgin Islands, American Samoa, right? They are still on the list of non-self-governing territories, which Hawaii was taken off after the Statehood Act. So there are various mechanisms for the youth, our Hawaiian youth, to be able to go up to the United Nations and talk about it. And I think it's all healthy for the dialogue of what we have faced as a people historically.
I think as we reflect on the 30, 40 years that have passed, to know that there are people out there, the younger generations, right, that may not be real clear on the history and how things evolved. And so it's important to lay that out and, I guess, deepen the understanding of the political relationship that we have versus the Native tribes in
the
U.S.
That is correct. And, of course, we have the Hawaiian Council's Native Hawaiian Convention that's going to be occurring in Washington State the first week of October, which I plan to go to, with hundreds of community members, not just from Hawaii, but across the country. And I think that this is helpful because we just need to share information. I know that there is a lot of concerns, a lot of fear, but that fear is not isolated to the people of Hawaii. It's across the country and quite frankly, elsewhere in the world. And what we need to do is strengthen, again, all of the good things that have happened with our community and to share with our community and to the general public that we're going to be okay. And whatever it's going to take to weather it, we're going to get through this storm and we're going to prevail.
So whether it's concern for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands and homesteading or the cuts to federal programs that help to uplift Native Hawaiians or Kamehameha School's admissions policy.
That is correct. Yes, that won't be our primary focus. We want to just talk about all of the good that has been going on the last 30, 40 years, but we would welcome questions in that regard because we probably have all different perspectives. So what I thought I'd do is bring a cadre of people who have various levels of expertise. Of course, Kori Haya, who is the chief of staff for U.S. Senator Mazie Hirono, is deep in the throes of what is going on there, including the potential shutdown of the federal government. This is occurring on September 30th, which, of course, is the end of the fiscal year, and we're going to know whether or not the government is going to be shut down. Regardless of whatever happens, she will be on this panel. She will be the one that will be via Zoom, but she will give you what's going on now. I will be giving the historical perspective. Cully Watson and Brianne Ujiva will be talking about all of the good things that have gone on at the state level. And again, Brandon Maka'ava'ava and Lily Kala Kame'elehiva will be talking about the good work that's been going on the international level.
All right. Thank you so much for helping to organize this. And yeah, good luck tomorrow.
Okay, take care.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Councilwoman Esther Kia'aina. She will take part in a forum talking about the political history of Hawaiians and the future threats to funding, which takes place at tomorrow at 10 a.m. Look for links on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Outdoor Living in Honolulu and Kahului, with furnishings to help create a personal oasis and opportunities for spending time on the lanai with family and friends. OutdoorLivingHawaii.com.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. We were already excited to come to Honolulu to do two shows at the Blaisdell Concert Hall, but now we're beside ourselves with excitement because on October 9th, we'll be joined by ukulele virtuoso Taimane, and on October 10th, we get to talk to Olympic gold medal surfer Carissa Moore. I just feel sorry for the people who have to decide which one to go to. For tickets, hey, maybe to both, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/waitwait.
Sponsored by Honolulu Financial Partners and Hawaii Pacific University.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters La Piha Makahiki, a 100% ka'u blend with notes of strawberry jam, brown sugar, and sweet lime at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
Hawaii Business Magazine has a new editor who sat down with us to reflect on her first 100 days and the view from where she sits. Jennifer Ablon returned home from New York after 3 decades to take the job leading the magazine. We invited her in to talk about where she hopes to take the magazine in a changing media landscape.
I've been away for 3 decades. I lived in New York City, and I have to say, this is the first time in my career that I'm engaging and covering the business community. It's been really fascinating and interesting, and talking to locals also. I went from one island, Manhattan, to another island, Honolulu, Hawaii, and we're discussing the same topics. We're discussing the labor market, inflation, high cost of living, what AI is going to do to our businesses. So I have found that the issues that we talk about, we think are local issues, but they're national issues as well. And so that's one of the things that I'd like to talk about in our pages, that the localized stories are really national stories as well.
The one that comes to mind recently was mapping out the ICE bus or the raids.
I think the last summer week in Manhattan, I saw an ICE raid at one of the hotels on the Upper East Side. And my managing editor, Ken Wills, I met him at Reuters in New York when we were working together. He lives on the Big Island, and he said, why don't we do an ICE map? Immigration, it's very much the topic du jour. And he said, why don't we do something that involves multimedia? So we launched the ICE map for businesses. Every single story that we run has a business and or finance angle. So we really did this for the business community. We know that a lot of hotels, restaurants, small businesses employ immigrants. And so this was something that we did for the community.
And it resonated.
808 Viral reposted us, and it went viral.
Since you've come on board, you're looking at a number of things. One of your reporters did something on the boycott of the U.S. by our friends in Canada, oh, Canada. And, you know, to see the numbers drop, you know, like they have is startling.
It's extremely startling and disturbing. I was looking at some of the pre-pandemic numbers, and Canadians contributed over $1 billion in spending during the first 7 months right ahead of the COVID crisis. That's a lot of dollars. And for the Canadians to fully boycott what they consider their second home, home away from home, has tremendous ripple effects, not just for the housing market here, because they also own homes here, but restaurants, right, hotels.
All the small businesses.
They're feeling it.
Yeah.
They're feeling it. And a double whammy on top of that is that the Japanese are also not coming the way that they used to because of the weakness in the yen.
You also had one of your reporters interview. How would you describe that segment?
So Ryan Noelani Kule is one of our crack reporters, and she came to me with this idea to interview a YouTuber, Guard the Leaf. But the only way Guard the Leaf would do an interview with Ryan is if he could do it anonymously, because he was afraid of the backlash from the Trump administration. And I said, give me 24 hours to think about it. I went back to her and I said, go for it. She does an extensive interview with Guard the Leaf about why Canadians have boycotted Hawaii and the U.S. I've seen this all over the country. They're nowhere to be found, also in New York City. And she does this 10-minute interview, and it got over 90,000 views. I call him Mr. Leaf. I call him Mr. Leaf. So Mr. Leaf storified the whole interview because he said people think that words do not travel, and they do. He said that the president's insults were damaging to the country. He also mentions that even if we had a new president, the Canadians would still be reluctant to come back because of the insults.
Yeah, you've broken that trust. So we'll see how we recover from that. But just the use of the multimedia, you know, you folks are exploring it as opposed to just picking up the magazine at the store or subscribing, right? You folks are reaching out in different ways just because you're trying to grow your audience.
Right. But at the same time, I would love for our audience to experience our stories in different ways. So the YouTube interview, it's intriguing because Ryan explained to Mr. Leaf about how Hawaii came to be, and a lot of Canadians didn't know the annexation. So it really was an eye-opener for not only Canadians, but other people who may not, you know, Hawaii's very far away. I mean, we are miles away from the mainland, and people think that it's all beach, margaritas, pina coladas. We have a lot of great, interesting issues happening here. And so, again, the YouTube video really went deep into Hawaii's history.
Right, it was a good teaching moment.
Yeah.
You got their attention, and yes, let's go and try and understand what's happening and
right,
the context.
And so, yeah, it just blew up. The video and Mr. Leaf's experience in Hawaii and how much he loves the islands and his mother frequents Hawaii. It's also emotional to hear these personal stories and how people are unfortunately not coming back.
Well, you can connect with your readers on just different levels.
Right. So we're doing YouTube, and also we are doing read alouds on Instagram. So we have journalists and collaborators read parts of our stories. We're also on LinkedIn. We have a Hawaii Business LinkedIn newsletter. And equally important, we are out there with events every single month. So our Wahine Forum is on October 24th, and we also have our Money Matters event and our CEO event. So I have found that these events are highly attended because it's just, I think, a byproduct of COVID. People want to get out and meet other people.
And you also cover issues that are pertinent to small business and big business. And I think that's just an important thing, right, to connect with your readers.
Right. I mean, we also want to write about and cover the unnoticed stories. We are launching a new column called Trial and Error. It is about 20 and 30 somethings. We often talk about millennials, Gen Zers, Gen Alpha, and I'm going to bring up Ryan's name again because she's going to be the lead columnist. It is a column dedicated to 20 and 30 somethings. I call them the next generation. Some people hate that word. But the debut column is going to talk about young adulthood in Hawaii. And she's going to be talking about how she budgets in one of the most expensive states in the nation. So I'm looking forward to that because in her opening line, she talks about how this month she opened up her bank account. She had less than $50. So, you know, navigating with the high cost of living paired with limited job opportunities as a young adult, you have to strategize and figure out, is this going to be my life in the next 5 years?
Well, I think, you know, if we both flash back to when we were 20 and 30.
I'm living through her vicariously.
It was very hard. And you have those same dreams, you know, owning your own place. You just have these wants and desires. And yet when you look at the paycheck at the end of the day or at the end of the week, it's tough.
It's really tough.
I mean, you had to go away, right?
Yeah, I went away and I grew up in Kalihi, but I had really big dreams. And I told a professor at UH, I'd really like to make it big. And he said, you might want to try New York City, but it's not going to be easy. He was right. It wasn't easy. But you have to figure out what you want in life. And you also want to make sure that you love what you do. That page is dedicated to the 20 and 30 somethings talking about their struggles and also about their wins. And so we want to go out there and not just interview big CEOs and the C-suite executives. We want to talk to everyone.
Well, you know, it's just an interesting time for media companies, Hawaii Public Radio, along with Hawaii Business, just because of how technology is changing things so fast and we have to adapt.
Federal funding cuts.
Exactly. And so, yeah, we have to get creative to reach an audience and to survive.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a smallish newsroom. And I have told every single journalist, put on your multimedia hat on. I have to say it's working because we not only do that, but we support each other. So I'm learning from different generations. I mean, now I know how to use my reels properly and LinkedIn. And it's just been a great way to learn new technology.
All right. Well, Jennifer Ablon, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Hawaii Business Editor Jennifer Ablon talking to us. She sat down in our studios last week. She's just returned home to take the helm at the magazine. Close to 200 native birds have been killed on Kauai just in the last 2 weeks. That's according to a local conservation group's Archipelago Research and Conservation recently discovered 125 birds dead at Nanini Point near the Lihue Airport. All had been killed by cats. A social media post showing carcasses of the birds quickly went viral. Science Director Andre Rain spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the devastating scene.
Someone called us, a bird watcher who'd seen several dead uauukani in the colony when he was out at the site. So we just went to investigate and see what was going on there and just found absolute carnage. We had 125 dead uauukani. Most of them were adults, although there were some chicks as well. It was clear it was all from cats. There was cat feces with seabird feathers in them. All of the bodies had injuries that are consistent with cat depredation. Cats they're very messy eaters. They'll tear chunks out of the birds, take off the back of the head to get at the brain. So very clear indications that this was a cat kill, probably multiple animals, and that it had been going on all season, because we actually found one bird, and this was particularly tragic, where the body of the bird still had the egg inside it. So, you know, that's a bird which never even got a chance to lay. It was during the egg laying period. So clearly the birds are just being picked off over the course of the season, all the way up into the point where we went there, because we found two chicks that had been killed the previous night. We only had a chance to check about a quarter of the colony, so I'm sure there's more dead birds out there. And it was the third mass kill we've seen in the last few weeks. So, you know, although this is the biggest one, it's not unusual on Kauai to get large cat kills or dog kills of this particular species. Because they do breed on the coast and they breed near urban areas, they're particularly vulnerable to introduced predators like cats and dogs.
What do you and other researchers know about the cat colonies on Kauai, like where they are and whether or not they're fed, and so whether this hunting behavior is tied to food for them or just, I mean, cats are known to hunt for sport, so whether it could be that.
Well, we have a huge cat population on this island. We spend a lot of our time working in really remote areas up in the mountains, particularly the northwest of the island, and you find cats from the very top of the mountains all the way down to the coast. So there's feral cats everywhere. There are cat colonies, cat feeding colonies, where large numbers of cats congregate to be fed. And so the cats are everywhere. And we know, like you said, cats will, they'll either eat for food, or if they're not hungry, they also just hunt for their own enjoyment. So in this case, it looked like quite a lot of the birds have actually been eaten, partially eaten. And this is another issue, is that particularly with a species like the uaukani, they're a social animal. So they breed in a colony where their burrows are all close together. And a cat or a dog that gets into a colony like this will just hammer multiple birds over. They can do it over a very short period of time. And what cats will do is, if there's a lot of food around, then they'll pull out a bird, eat the most energy-rich part of the body, like the brain or some of the chest, and then they'll discard it, move on to the next one, because it's just more efficient for them to kill multiple birds and eat the highest energy-rich portions of the body than eating just a single bird. So they can devastate colonies really rapidly if left to their own devices.
And just, I mean, how does it feel as someone who works in conservation and knowing the history of the conservation of these birds to see what feels like so much of that work undone in the span of a couple weeks, losing 125 birds?
It's tragic. It's devastating to see. And it's also extremely frustrating because we just get this year after year. This is one of the biggest cat kills I've ever seen. But looking through my records, 80 in one spot in 2013, 100 in another spot in 2020, you know, it's not an isolated scenario. It happens year in, year out all over the island. And so it's frustrating to see this and to know that there are ways that it can be stopped. Responsible cat owners should be keeping cats inside where they're safe and where they're not going to kill Hawaiian wildlife. Feral cat colonies should not be on the landscape, and responsible dog owners should be keeping their dogs on leads. So it's frustrating. And it makes me really annoyed to see this time and time again. Sort of feel kind of powerless, because like, why is this still happening now? Why are we still in this situation each year?
Hawaii Island recently passed a bill banning the feeding of feral animals, including cats, in public parks and other county property. What's the temperature of something like that happening on Kauai?
I mean, I think it should happen. And I think, you know, the vast majority of people on the island would support that. So I think, you know, that is one way of dealing with the problem, is to just remove feral cats from the landscape. And don't get me wrong, I'm a cat lover. Like, I have my own cat. I've always had cats all the way through my life, but indoor cats are the way to go. And I understand why people like cats, because they can be a very affectionate animal. They're very intelligent. They're beautiful, but they should not be on our landscape. And they are having a massive impact on Hawaiian wildlife, be it the uaukani, be it Hawaiian monk seals through toxoplasmosis, be it the endangered alae-ula. They will predate and kill all of these birds, and they have these knock-on effects with other Hawaiian animals, and they're not meant to be on this landscape, and they need to be off.
What to you is the roadblock? Like, why has it been so hard to do something about this problem?
I think one of the things that people need to do is start appreciating the birds and connecting with them. So, you know, everyone knows what a cat is, but people don't necessarily know what a shearwater is, or it's just a bird. And so understanding that these are highly intelligent animals that can live 30 or 40 years, that will travel hundreds of kilometers to go and catch fish in the Great Blue Ocean and bring this food back to these fuzzy little chicks that are sitting waiting, super vulnerable in their burrows. I think if people can connect with them and see these birds and appreciate them and understand why they're so important on this island, I think that will start making people more receptive. The small group of people who would not be receptive to removing cats in the landscape, I think that might make them more connected, because everyone's an animal lover, right? I mean, if you love cats, you're an animal lover. If you work with birds, you're an animal lover. So I think it's just understanding that if you're focused entirely on an introduced predator, which is what the cat is, to the exclusion of all other animals, then you're not really an animal lover at all. You're just a cat lover, right? You've got to focus on a single species, and we've got to sort of broaden that.
I know you've said you have seen mass kills, not of this size, but, you know, of this nature, of similar sizes in the past. And just like, where do you put all those emotions? How do you deal with the devastation?
Well, I think the way to deal with it is to collect the data, to report it to the authorities, and to get it out there to the general public. That's how I deal with it, because, you know, it is extremely frustrating. The colony at Mahalapu, for example, which we found 16 dead birds a couple weeks ago, I'd been watching that colony. I go and walk in that area, you know, once or twice a month. And I was just commenting to my wife about, oh, it's great. This colony's like been increasing this year. It's looking really good. They're like all over the place. You can see chicks here. And I said to her, I'll bet you at some point we're going to find some dead birds. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, there you go. There's a bunch of dead birds killed by a dog in that particular case. So documenting that kind of these events and getting that information out there and passing it on to the authorities, these are the ways in which I deal with it.
Is there anything else you want to add or anything you want listeners to know right now?
Firstly, we're very fortunate on Kauai. We are a seabird island. We can see all these amazing seabirds in multiple different places like Kilauea Point. You can go down to shipwrecks and see seabirds. You can stand on the shore and see seabirds. And so we need to appreciate these animals. And I would recommend that if people do not know what an uapukani is, they should go to somewhere like Kilauea Point or down to shipwrecks and wait till dusk when the night's falling and the birds are coming back to feed their chicks. And just watching them and seeing how graceful they are, watching them coming into the shoreline. I think the more that people see these animals, the more they'll come to appreciate them.
That was Andre Rain, Science Director for Archipelago Research and Conservation, talking about a mass killing of native birds by what they believe is a colony of feral cats on Kauai.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, on view through October 12th, Mary Cassatt at work. The impressionist dared to take the lives of women seriously as subject matter for her art. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Aloha, this is Hawaii Public Radio CEO Meredith Artley, and I have a great message for you. We received more than $620,000 in gifts in our first full fundraiser since the funding cuts were made to public media, and our membership levels are hitting new highs. Mahalo to more than 1,800 of you who stepped up. HPR is now moving forward 100% community backed.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
As Hawaiian History Month draws to a close, we want to spotlight an event that began decades ago. In 1993, writer of Victoria Nalani Nuble was asked to write a play commemorating the 100th anniversary of the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii. The script she produced was a sprawling pageant that was performed over several days for thousands of people. When Nuble was approached about mounting the production again, she decided to pen a shorter version that could be performed as a walking tour in the physical spaces where much of the story takes place. That became Mai Poina, which was performed every year under the grounds of Iolani Palace until the COVID pandemic came along. But the show was back this year, and The Conversation G.W. Gibson talked to Nuble about the history and intention behind the show.
When I graduated my master's program at the University of Hawaii in Drama and Theater, I went to work at the Mission Houses Museum. There were two people working there, my supervisor, Deborah Pope, and this man named Glenn Grant, who used to do a lot of walking tours and things in Honolulu. But Deborah and Glenn are actually the first people who introduced living history as performance genre to the islands. Glenn and I also did tours together, and we did one about the overthrow, where I was a royalist and he was an annexationist, and we did some research, and basically we walked around town yelling at each other. It was pretty fun. And then a woman named Alice Vogler, she was a Kamehameha School graduate. She had been a director in Los Angeles of theater. She also became part of the Blue Ribbon Committee for the commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the overthrow in 1993. And she asked me, after she saw the tour, because she knew I was a playwright, she asked me to write a play that she could direct about the overthrow. And so I wrote this really long, it was like a play slash pageant. It had 54 speaking parts, and Dallas took it, and I thought she was just going to do it in all one shot, but she did it over the 4 days of the commemoration. And so that was the first incarnation of my Poena. And then in 2009, I got a call from the Hawaii Ponui Coalition. One of my friends was part of the coalition, asking if they could redo the pageant. It was the 50th anniversary of statehood, and the state had been planning all of these commemorations and celebrations of statehood, and the Hawaii Ponui Coalition wanted to remind people that we used to be an independent country and that our kingdom was unfairly taken away from us. So they asked me if they could redo the pageant, and I told them, I don't think you want to do that. You know, it had 54 speaking parts, and they had called me in the spring, and they wanted to do it in August. And there was just no way that there was enough time to do that. So I told them I would take that script, and I'd rewrite it into something that was much more manageable and something that could accommodate a lot of people and would cover the same material in a much shorter period of time. So that's how the script got written and produced the first time in 2009. And I believe this is the first time since COVID that it's been revived. So I was so happy to see it again.
I had the good fortune of joining one of the tours, and I couldn't help but feel in on the commitment that each of the performers had, and they brought so much to the experience of the tour. Talk a little bit about what it's like to perform in this and what you hope the other performers will bring to it.
Well, the material in my Poena is extremely important to me. It was a history that I was totally denied when I was growing up. I really didn't know anything about those events or those issues until I went to college and I started looking into it like other people my age did. And then I remembered that when I was a little girl, the woman I'm named after was a friend of my grandmother. She was an older woman, and she had actually been through some of those events. She was older than my grandmother. And she used to talk about them to us when we were kids. And it left a big impression on me. But we didn't have any context to put it in. All of these things she was telling us. And you know how when you're little and someone is talking to you, you absorb all of their emotions that are unspoken as a child. And my cousin and I think we did that. And so when I started to actually learn about all these events, I think part of that experience as a child reinforced my commitment to wanting other people to know about them too. And even today, I don't think this history is really well taught, at least in public schools. I know in college, if you decide to take certain courses, of course, you'll learn about it. But yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why everyone in it is committed to it.
Yeah, and I think that these points you just made about not hearing this history, or a point is so important. The walking tour that I joined, it ended at a certain point where we were greeted by UH Hawaiian history professor John Osorio, and he spoke a little bit to the audience, and then he opened up the floor to take questions from people that were there. But he made a very important point. He said this history really only began getting heard, getting taught, getting spoken about during the Hawaiian Renaissance during the 1970s. And that means that we've really only been thinking about this culturally in a shared way for the last 50 years, which is a small breath of time when you consider how far back this history goes. And I guess I wonder what part you hope this text will play in sharing that history, especially as we move forward and try to make it a more common or shared understanding.
Well, I think it's really important for Kanaka Maoli to know that history, but it's also important for non-Hawaiians to know that history too, especially those people who want to make this place their home. You know, because of the way I look at the political situation that we're in now, I feel it's really important for all of us who love this place and who want to live here to understand each other's history and to come together in a mutual understanding of each other's history and how we came to be in this place and how we might move forward from that. Because to me, Hawaii is an extremely special place, especially because there's so many different races here and we do a pretty good job of getting along. And so I think unless we all understand our history, we really can't make good decisions about moving forward, because that history really never leaves us. It becomes a part of who we are. I think it's so important to provide a space in our community that's safe for people to hear about this history and be able to ask questions and feel totally comfortable doing it. I don't think there are too many spaces where we can do that in the community, and this provides one of those spaces. So that question and answer period is almost as important to me as you watching it, too.
Yeah, and I was happy to see that there was a really great mixture of people who were there, again, at least for the tour that I joined, and I got to interact with some of the folks that were listening in, and I met people that grew up in Hawaii and spoke about, oh yeah, I think I remember traces of this in fourth grade history class. And I met people from Pennsylvania and Texas who this was just square one for them. But I think that, as you just pointed out, whoever you are, even if you know some of this history, there's something about A, having it come to life in front of you, and B, really cementing your understanding or furthering your understanding.
Yeah, the thing about living history is that it makes you understand that history actually happened to real people like you. And I think that was the really attractive thing to me about living history. I almost flunked history in high school. But when I got involved in living history and I started reading primary source material, I realized that history did happen to real people like me. And it made it so much more accessible and personal. And I think that's the real value of living history, is it's that personal connection that you make with people from the past, even though those are actors there, but they're representing people from the past and they have a voice, they have a human voice. And I think that makes a big difference in our deeper understanding of issues.
That was Victoria Nalani Newbold talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson about Mai Poina, the Overthrow Walking Tours. We'll have more from the performers in the show after a short break.
Join us on Saturday, October 4th at 2 p.m. for an intimate event from HPR's Live from the Atherton and The Moth. Learn more about crafting your story from director and producer of The Moth, Michelle Jalowski. Seating in our Atherton studio is limited. Tickets are available at hprtickets.org.
Hawaii Public Radio brings the community together through our multi-platform Live from the Atherton event series. From jazz to classical, Hawaii Public Radio showcases local musicians in an intimate studio setting. We also welcome authors to host readings and discussions about their work.
This is a story, a mo'olelo. It's not really my story, but it involves me. Sometimes as a subject, sometimes as an unwitting object, sometimes as an unwilling participant. A mo'olelo that does not involve the teller is almost worthless. Just about as worthless as a story that is only about the teller.
Can't join us in person? Watch previous performances online on hawaiipublicradio.org/watch.
Now that we've heard from the writer of My Po'ino, we want to leave you with a taste of one of the Overthrow walking tours. The conversation C.W. Gibson spoke with a couple of the actors about what the experience means to them and captured a few minutes of their performance.
We don't want people to forget that Hawaii was once an independent country with a strong national identity whose independence was wrongfully taken away, and we unapologetically present this tour from the perspective of those loyal to the Hawaiian nation and the Queen. We feel that the other side has told this story for over 100 years from their perspective, and now we want people to understand it from our perspective.
My name is Alakai Cunningham. I play the first interpreter, who is sort of like they set like the background information for the beginning of the show, so people have the like historical context of what's going on prior to the events that transpire through the performance.
Aloha and welcome. My name is Alakai. I heard that you are interested in learning what's happening in our kingdom, so I'm here today to tell you a bit about our political history. I see there are many Kanaka Maoli in this group, so please pardon me for telling you things you must already know. I hope it is helpful for those of you who have just arrived in our Honolulu of January 1893.
Pretty unique performing experience, not in any kind of traditional theater. Talk about the special quality of performing in the space where you're performing by the palace on the grounds where the story takes place.
Yeah, you often, when you perform a piece, you know where it takes place and you have to do, like, you use your imagination to put yourself in that perspective. But being able to actually perform it here on the palace grounds, like, you can feel the mana, you know, you can feel the history surrounding you. I feel like it's almost infectious, like the energy. It bleeds into the performance and it bleeds into the audience. Everybody can feel it, and it really gets people in the correct mindset to see the story.
Hawaiian Kingdom was forged by Kamehameha I in 1810 through his unification of the Hawaiian Islands. When Kamehameha I died, his rule was passed to his son, Liholiho Kamehameha II. In 1824, when Kamehameha II died, Kalani Kauwikioli became Kamehameha III. It was during Kauwikioli's reign that Hawaii began to seriously adopt the ways of Western government. In 1840, when he granted a constitution, Kauwikioli established the Hawaiian Kingdom as a constitutional monarchy.
It does seem like we have a really good mix of locals who have probably heard this story many times, who want to see it again and like always remember the history, as well as people who are from here but they might not be familiar with the history, and people visiting who want to learn and find out the history of the place that they're visiting on vacation. And they always seem to leave with like a greater appreciation and understanding for what the people of these islands, you know, went through and the history that brought us to today.
The Reform Party, as the annexationists call themselves, still can't take control over the legislature.
Oh, I remember that.
Oh, everybody, this is Mr. Ah Sing. He owns a store over in Chinatown. Yes, Uncle. Tell us if you remember.
Sir, can I get your name and understand what role you play?
Sure. My name is John Watt. I play Mr. Ah Sing, who's a Chinese businessman.
And how did you get involved in this production?
I've been involved for a few years. So actually, I've done this part several times. And a bunch of us actually have done it. it's very close to home because I'm Chinese as well. And my family was here in 1860. So it's like very, very close to home. And then also too, this whole production is sort of reduced version of Vicky's original overthrow that was down here in for, you know, 10,000, 15,000 people. And I was here on the first day of that. So I remember that very, very close. So it's kind of exciting to be a part of it. The big production, which was much larger, on much larger scale, was done all over in the grounds here. And it was really kind of amazing experience because literally there were 10,000 people here on the first night and it got bigger. And this is sort of a kind of version of it that's much smaller, but it allows people to come and do a kind of a little version of it and, you know, walk around and see what it was like to be here in that time and imagine it. We've also done it, we actually took it to Kamehameha schools on Maui. And that was kind of fun. In my monologue, I make reference to Howley's, you know, and I had to look out in the audience at Kamehameha schools and I said, there are no blonde heads here. What am I going to do? So that was kind of fun.
I remember those Howley. Oh, sorry. Those sorted Howley businessmen. They threatened the king. Force him to sign that paper.
And you mentioned your family history. Do you know much about your family history? I mean, you know when they arrived here in the islands, but yeah, any more color you can provide there?
Well, my grandmother was actually born in the Big Island in 1890, around there. So, and my great-grandfather and his father were businessmen on the Big Island. I ran a store, and so we like to trace our history back to the 19th century. We were members of this community while it was a kingdom, so that's kind of exciting for us.
And it seems like that sort of personal connection is part of this experience for you and meaningful for you.
Absolutely. So much so.
We respect the queen. They're the greedy ones. They're the ones who threaten everybody.
Okay, uncle. thanks for telling us how you feel.
That was Alika'i Cunningham and John Watt, performers in the Mai Poina, the Overthrow Walking Tours at the Palace. We'll have videos and pictures from the performance on our website later today. Well, that is it for us today. Tomorrow, the rebranded Hawaiian Council looks to its upcoming conference at a resort and casino, land owned by a native tribe. What's on your mind? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Did you know you can find the conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.